Welcome to Tochity. We are a collective that aims to bring to light the stories behind the stories in Russia's ongoing illegal invasion of Ukraine. My name is Alex, and today we are joined by Colby and John to talk about Colby's recent Attackums thread, which has received some popular acclaim. Colby, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Bathing in the success of your thread, no doubt.
Yeah, I've been very touched by all the support and encouragement and appreciation from everybody that was so kind as to read it. So yeah, it's been great.
And of course, no conversation about Attacums would be complete without John. How are you, John?
I'm very well, Alex. This fun evening.
So we thought we'd have a little chat about the thread and some of the sources that you drew from and some of the questions that arose and some of the feedback that you've received after it's been published. So why do you think it was important that this information be put out there?
Yeah, so ever since Attackums kind of came into the discourse around the war, which was pretty early on, I guess, that Ukraine was asking for the HIMARS launching system and the Attackums missile, which is one of the munitions that can use. There's been a lot of bad information floating around about the system, its capabilities, what it can do, what it can't do, what it's good for, how many of them are there, how many have been produced. Everybody seemed to have a different take on all of those different things, and I was compelled to try and actually get to the bottom of it and see if I could figure out an actual answer using available open source information, because just in my initial sort of investigation, it was very clear to me that a lot of things being said were definitely not true. And funnily enough, even some of the things that Lockheed Martin, who makes the missile, were purportedly saying to different media outlets were also very clearly not true. One particular example being the claim that 500 missiles were being produced on a yearly basis and for a different people, depending on which particular news organization happened to be writing. It seems that different organizations were told different things, and that was something that was very obviously not true based on publicly open source information available that didn't take much investigation to get the bottom of. So that really further encouraged me to finish the research project and get to the point where I was comfortable releasing it, being pretty confident that I had gotten everything right and established the actual answer. So
Attackums has really become like this informational sort of thing that is just sort of conjured to both show Western supremacy and, you know, sort of shame what we could be doing more. And I think it's important that we add the reality and the details of these things so that we can understand them. And I mean, one thing that really struck out to me was that the numbers that the DoD refer to as the stock that they hold vary wildly depending on the source that you consult. John has certainly said that to me before, is that different sources quote different numbers, and DoD sources to say, well, that there's just not enough to send is probably not entirely consistent with the open source information.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and capabilities was a you know, another big thing where you had some people saying that Attackums is this wonder weapon that will solve all of Ukraine's problems, and other people saying no, Attackums doesn't matter at all, it's useless, or Storm Shadow is better, or they don't need it because they have Storm Shadow, and just take your pick in the broad spectrum of very bad takes. I felt it was necessary to actually bring the facts and clarify what is the truth about Attackums, which is that it's a unique capability, even for unique even for the United States, really. Certainly unique for much of the NATO alliance. There's not many countries that have anything comparable to it, certainly not in large quantities. And it's something that Ukraine needs, but definitely not some sort of wonder weapon that's going to win the war as soon as it makes an appearance on the battlefield. So there's a lot of nuance missing in a lot of the conversations that we have around the war in Ukraine, or just so many things in life in general. That's basically the motivation of why I sunk months of effort into research and writing the thread.
As I think I said, it's the first comprehensive discussion of this system that I think I've seen. Certainly even in like the think tank space, I think it's the first real discussion of what it is and the capabilities of it. Was there anything that sort of jumped out for you, John?
I would just add to that. I agree with you, Alex. There has been a frustrating lack of technical detail in the sense that not just in terms of what U.S. inventory looks like for ATACMS, you know, what the history of the procurement of the system looks like, but more so, I guess, from an employment standpoint, from a weaponeering standpoint, what capability does it bring to the table? And Colby spoke to this, you know, just a minute ago, but there really is, from my point of view, just a staggering magnitude of misunderstanding about what, not just, I guess, even just ATACM specifically, what a ballistic missile system does, what it is useful for, the types of targets that it can hold at risk, the type of mission set for which its employment is ideal, relative to, say, cruise missiles, be they ground-launched, air-launched, etc. There's just a large degree of technical either non-understanding or misunderstanding from a lot of people that probably should have known better.
Yeah. Yeah. Strong agree with that. This is a perennial problem. In anything in life, you'll have somebody who has some sort of expertise in some category, and then some people will let a little bit of their expertise or a little bit of the clout that they have go to their head and then try and extend their expertise into sort of adjacent areas in which they really should not be speaking about, and they should know better because they should know their limitations and their lane, right? So, and to be clear, I never served in the military, but I never claim that I do, and there are people that have served or are actively serving that might have a particular, you know, they might be in the Air Force or the Navy or the Army, and then within that, they might have a, you know, you have your MOS is, you know, in the Army, what your assignment is, and some people will stray out of things that they know about and start talking about totally unrelated things that they don't actually have any background in, but because they have sort of established themselves as somebody who has some level of relevant experience, a lot of people fall into believing them when they start pontificating about other topics. So you could be an infantry soldier and then start pontificating about naval warfare or air warfare, which you don't have any relevant experience in, but a lot of people will believe you just because there's some sort of perceived expertise there. And that's very unhelpful for a lot of the discourse around the war, I would say.
And this is one of the perennial issues around OSINT. I guess this is something like one of the things that we try and do is make sure that we track down sources so that, because this is a volunteer project and this is essentially, for a lot of our members and participants, it's a hobby, as well as a passion and a cause that they believe in. And we always try and make sure that we have the receipts. I think this is something that some people might point out, that we are sometimes slow to respond to different events that occur. And that's because we want to make sure that we have the receipts, that we have a clear idea of what's going on and an understanding of what's going on. And I think a piece like yours that's well thought out and well researched and well constructed is an example of what OSINT can do on a good day. And as you say, on an average day, it can be quite patchy. I don't know if you have any further thoughts on that after this kind of project.
Yeah, no, 100%. I'm big on sourcing personally. There's a lot of people who have opinions of stuff, and certainly I have many opinions as well. And I try and do my best of, you know, saying when I'm just offering an opinion about something versus, hey, I actually have sourcing on this, you know, which is, if I'm going to make some sort of factual claim, then, you know, I try to do my best to actually bring the receipts, as you said, and I feel like that's a standard that, you know, really we should all be holding ourselves to, but there are a lot of people that unfortunately do not seem to hold themselves to that standard, and that's created an awful lot of misinformation, you know, not just about Attackums, but everything, you know, in this war and more broadly to do with open source intelligence.
What I'd add to that, if I may, is even just looking beyond OSINT, it's not just a perennial issue with open source intelligence specifically. It's a perennial issue, for example, with journalism, that most journalists are, you know, they're no fault of their own, you know, just simply not subject matter experts in what they report on. Typically, there's a lot of folks in the policy and the strategic studies sphere that have been, you know, very active in the commentary and analysis about the war, who have no background in technical subjects, for example. They may be, you know, really fantastic at, you know, policy, you know, from a policy standpoint, but, you know, they kind of lack that core hard technical background. And unfortunately, I think in both cases, it's been to the detriment of public understanding of both the war, the Russo-Ukrainian war, as well as perhaps, you know, just war and global security as a discipline in general.
Yeah, 100% agree with John on that. I often very much share his frustration with journalists, particularly in the defense security sphere, who really are lacking a lot of knowledge that they really need to be more effective at their jobs on reporting on war, conflict. And maybe a final thought on that before let Alex move on to a different question. You don't need to have a formal technical background to understand things, though. Certainly it can help, but I don't have a formal technical background in missiles, but you know, if you do the research and you're using good sources, you can acquire an understanding above that of somebody who may actually have some level of technical background, but they just haven't done the research. In case in point, there's been other people who have written things about Attackums. I know Michael Weiss a week ago maybe wrote just a few tweets about Attackums, and he's somebody that doesn't have a military or technical munitions background, but he was able to write from a technical perspective, you know, pretty good, concise information about Attackums, in contrast with some other people that I saw that were writing about Attackums who do, in fact, have a military and a technical background, who did not have the most accurate information about Attackums. So I agree with John that technical knowledge is useful. It definitely isn't a requisite at the same time. I think the most important thing is putting in the work, putting in the research, and coming at things with you know, the right sort of analytical framework, rather than a lot of people seem to have a conclusion in mind already that they want to get to, and they'll find the information in support of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the role of the enthusiastic amateur is well established, and something I certainly prescribe to. Fellow travelers in the historical railway scene, where often people who have never worked for the railways or have any engineering background can explain to you in detail the workings, design, and construction and history of locomotives at the drop of a hat. And yeah, I think enthusiastic amateurs, good place to start. So in terms of, so I guess one of the big questions is, why do you think it's important that Ukraine receives these weapon systems? I know you touched on it in your thread, but is there anything you would have liked to have added to that?
Yeah, good question. This is something that I actually had in my mind that I wanted to say, and it's good you asked this now. Believe it or not, many people were saying, oh, this is like the most comprehensive thread that they've read about Attackums, or the most comprehensive thread that they've read about anything before, that's very generous of people to say. But believe it or not, there's an awful lot of information that could have been put in that wasn't. And that's probably a good thing, because it was already extremely long. And I'm sure I scared a few people off with the length, but I don't think that I If I tried to cut it short, I would have been sacrificing on things that were important in my mind. So, but I at some point you have to say you have to finish. You can't just keep throwing more in there. So, but there's all sorts of things that could have been in there or just could have been expanded upon and discussed at more length. But for brevity's sake, especially writing on the medium of Twitter rather than as a more structured formal research paper that you might read from a think tank, some of which could be 100 or 200 pages long, there were things that I left out. Yeah, I think I did a fairly succinct job of covering the why Attackums is important. I wanted it to be understandable for a layman with no prior understanding of munitions or military matters or strategic matters. The feedback I got is that part was all pretty clear, so I'm happy with how that turned out, explaining why Attackums is important. So, I mean, the first thing that I would say beyond that, which wasn't stated in the thread because it just so sort of self-evident, I guess, is that the Ukrainian government is asking for it. And I think in most cases, you know, we should basically take them at their word of what their requirements are. And I think that, you know, based on the asks of the Ukrainian government that we're aware of through, you know, the public reporting and what they say publicly in front of the cameras, their asks are pretty reasonable. They're not asking for the United States to give them nuclear missiles or aircraft carriers or strategic bombers. I think that the asks from the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense are pretty reasonable. So when they're saying we need Attackums, this is an important capability, really the conversation should end there in my mind. But unfortunately, the decision makers in Western capitals, many of them are not willing to provide certain systems, Attackums being one of them. Hopefully that'll change soon, but Attackums has been, I guess, a red line, so to speak, so far for the Biden administration in the United States. Why is Attackums important beyond the fact that Ukraine is asking for them? Attackums is necessary for Ukraine to be able to reliably go after time-sensitive targets, because Attackums, due to its nature being a quasi-ballistic missile fired from readily available ground launchers that Ukraine has close to the front line, can hit a Russian target with much more responsiveness and speed than Ukraine can do that with their current inventory of air-launched cruise missiles, Storm Shadow and Scalp EG, which are provided by United Kingdom and France. And, you know, kind of back to the lack of munitions understanding, a lot of people just look at, you know, what the range on paper of the missile is. You know, maybe they look at how big the warhead is. They might, you know, if it's publicly available, look at what the precision sort of is, how accurate is it, and it reliably actually hit a specific target, a small target, reliably without much collateral damage. And that's just all very surface level. There's a lot underneath that that you need to understand what the actual true capabilities of a system is. And John was touching on this earlier as well. Attackums is just a fundamentally different capability than Storm Shadow or Scalp EG or any other, most of any other cruise missile that Ukraine could plausibly receive, because it flies at much faster speeds. It's getting launched already in closer proximity to the front line. So the timeline to hit a Russian target that is mobile, that can relocate on short notice, or that is extremely dangerous and needs to be destroyed as quickly as possible, it's much more well-suited for that kind of target set. And Ukraine just doesn't have any capability that can do that at longer ranges right now. Because, you know, a Gimlers rocket, which is what Ukraine currently has for its M142 HIMARS and M270 MLRS and derivative launchers that have been donated, Gimlers has a 83 to 92 kilometer max range. So Attackums is more than triple that. So it puts a whole range of different Russian systems that are currently largely safe from being struck reliably by Ukraine into danger. And it's going to be very challenging for Ukraine to be able to make good progress when all of those systems are mostly off the table and their only Ukraine's only ability to destroy those is if the Russians are extremely, extremely careless. And we see that does happen. Ukraine has had some limited success in destroying Russians' time-sensitive targets at long range, like their surface-to-air missile batteries. But in order for those targets to be really put into danger, Ukraine needs a capability like ATACMS. So it's not good enough for them to just have in Scalp-EG. They need ATACMS too. So that's the main thing in terms of capability. And I guess the other important thing I would add is just that the supply of all of these missiles is finite. And we don't want Ukraine to just run out of Storm Shadows or Scalps. So providing ATACMS will ensure that they're not going to run out as quickly because they have a larger pool of missiles to draw on. So that's very important. And that gives a little bit of breathing room to figure out what other long-range missiles could be given to Ukraine, because they're definitely not going to win the war without any long-range precision fires. That's definitely a capability that you need to win this kind of war. It will be extremely challenging for them to win against Russia when there's a massive asymmetry if Ukraine doesn't have those capabilities at all and Russia does. So that's what I would say as to why Ukraine really needs to get ATACMS.
Absolutely. You mentioned long-range fires there, precision long-range fires. I presume one option that you sort of mentioned in passing in your thread was Taurus. I don't know too much about that system other than it's German and it's launched. Is it air launched? John is about to explain this to us, I think.
Yes. So Taurus, like Storm Shadow or Scalp-EG, it's an air launch, it's a low observable air launch cruise missile. I guess in terms of a high level description, the broad strokes of it are very similar to Storm Shadow and Scalp-EG, which is should be unsurprising. Both of them were developed, well, Storm Shadow and Scalp-EG were developed by NBDA UK and France, and NBDA Germany was the major contributor to Taurus's development, so shouldn't be super surprising on that front. They provide similar capabilities. Really, the only, again, from a high-level perspective, the major distinction from them is, or between them, I should say, is that Taurus has somewhat of a longer range. Storm Shadow / Scalp-EG, NBDA has, their official position on it is that as a range of, quote, greater than 250 kilometers based upon various RAF, like brochures and other material that's been as inadvertently disclosed over the years. It's pretty well known that its actual range is about 560 kilometers. That's, you know, we can't say for certain, but that's a, you know, an extremely reasonable assumption to make based upon the information that's publicly accessible. NBDA Germany, they've made various different claims about Taurus's range. The maximum that they've, I think, publicly cited it as is 500 kilometer range. But as it happens, I believe some documents, I think from the Bundestag that got released, indicated that its range was, I believe, somewhere in the ballpark of about 730-ish kilometers. So that's the first major distinction, is that Taurus is probably 50% greater range than Storm Shadow. That's not super relevant to Ukraine, to be honest, given that restrictions have been placed on all of these weapon systems in terms of not Ukraine being unable to use them to prosecute targets in Russia. They've been restricted to just using them against targets in occupied Ukraine. So that additional 250 kilometer or so range doesn't really get them much. What's more significant is Taurus has a different fuse system than Storm Shadow. Storm Shadow basically has a point detonate fuse option, which means it just detonates upon impact, and also has a delayed fuse option, which is more or less timer based. Activates a timer, you know, once an inertial sensor detects that it's impacted something, then after that timer's up, it detonates. Taurus has a more sophisticated fusing system that has, the term for it is a layer counting and void sensing fuse. So essentially what that means is that instead of just operating on a timer principle, it has, the fuse has a set of sensors in it that can more or less count layers of materials that it passes through, as well as voids between materials, by measuring the difference, the change in acceleration as it passes between layers of material and then, you know, voids. So you can precisely program it to detonate inside an object after it has passed through a certain number of layers of material or number of voids. That makes it, that enhances its capabilities relative to Storm Shadow and Scout BG against certain hardened targets. Bridges come to mind. One of the things that Taurus can do that, as far as I'm aware, Storm Shadow can't really do with the same degree of reliability, is that you can program Taurus to more or less, in a bridge attack mode, to punch straight through the road surface, and then from there basically just glide directly into, like, for example, a support column, then detonate against the column. You can use that void counting layer sensing fuse to do that. You can count the layers that passes through the road surface, count the voids once it exits, and then count the layers once it impacts the column. And you can, you know, you can fuse that extremely precisely to achieve the desired effect. With Storm Shadow, it's, you have to get your time right. It's a guessing game. You just have to hope you correctly guess the amount of time it will take that missile to travel between exiting the road surface and impacting a column, for example. It's you can do what you can replicate the effects of Taurus with Storm Shadow. It's just going to require a lot of Storm Shadows, and it's not very efficient. You require more to do this to achieve the same amount of effect. So in the context, again, of, you know, we see Ukraine execute strikes, so for example, on the Shanhar bridges between Crimea and, you know, mainland Ukraine, if you will. Obviously, there's been a variety of different strikes through various means against the Kerch Bridge. Taurus would be the ideal weaponeering solution for all of those targets, really, beyond just, you know, increasing Ukraine's magazine depth for stand-up munitions in the same way that TACAMS does.
Okay. Thank you for that, John. While we're talking technical, I've got a note here that says, ask John about malted milkshakes. What does that mean?
Oh, boy. So by malted milkshakes, I assume you mean multi-mode seekers for attack-ons.
That may make more sense than whatever I've scrawled here.
Yes. So this is something that Colby didn't really touch upon in his thread, mainly because it isn't super relevant to Ukraine. It's just, I guess it's an item of technical interest. One of the capabilities that TACAMS was slated to receive as of a couple years ago was a multi-mode seeker for terminal guidance. So for those who aren't really familiar, TACAMS, throughout as it currently stands, it has GPS, global positioning system, and INS, or inertial navigation system, guidance. So basically what that means, there's an inertial navigation system on board with a bunch of gyroscopes and accelerometers. It measures its acceleration, rotation, etc. And from that, you can do a bunch of math and estimate position. There's a lot of drift in that due to sensor measurement error, so you use GPS to correct it, so you don't lose precision with, you know, increased range, increased time of flight. And, you know, that system works very well, but one of the limitations of it is that more or less, you can only prosecute a fixed set of coordinates. You give the missile a set of coordinates, it navigates to that set of coordinates. That's it. There's no flexibility. You can't update what the intended point of impact is in flight. You can't track moving targets. You can't track naval vessels. There's limitations to it. So the one of the things the U.S. Army was looking at was adding a multi-mode seeker for terminal guidance that would take over from GPS INS as the missile descended. And I believe they were looking at essentially a radio frequency, a radar seeker, combined with a infrared and electro-optical seeker. Again, that multi-mode capability to enable it to be able to prosecute, you know, naval targets as well as moving land-based targets. I think that was funded in 2019, and it was supposed to be funded, I think, through 2023. And I think 2024, to the tune of, I think, $600 million, but that ended up being canceled after financial year 2019. And I believe that capability has basically been canned for TACAMS, and the Army decided they wanted to wait to implement that, I believe, on PrSM, a precision strike missile, TACAMS successor on Increment 2, I think.
Okay, thank you. And so, is there any likelihood that this is going to be developed and implemented and supplied to Ukraine, or is it?
which would be the second upgraded version of Prism that's going to be deployed in probably late 2020s, early 2030s.
I mean, obviously it would be good, but in the land of the real...
In the land of the real, I mean, it's not impossible, so maybe it's implausible. I don't know how many, you know, Seekers were actually produced, what their actual technical readiness was. The interesting thing from my standpoint in terms of looking at non-standard technical solutions here is that there's 75 Block 2 ATACMs from that limited number that were produced. We still have those, but we removed the warheads, the BAT, the Brilliant Anti-Tank Submunition Warheads. Those were all removed. So they're basically, I think, just motors at this point with maybe an associated guidance system. So if we wanted to look at, you know, maybe doing something weird or non-standard to meet whatever, you know, Ukrainian operational need, or if the Ukrainians want to do something with it themselves, if we just want to give them those, you know, missile bodies and tell them to get, you know, go knock yourselves out, you know, do whatever you want with it. That would be something that, you know, they could potentially look into. It might not be, you know, cost effective or time effective to do that, but I guess there's an avenue for that if there is an urgent operational need that either the DOD and the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, if they want to go down that option, that's there for them, potentially.
So I guess a question for both of you is, how far away are we from Ukraine receiving ATACMS?
ATACMS could be in Ukraine within a week of a decision being made, is my belief. The trouble we're having is that decision being made, and so far it hasn't been made. And you know, I think we are closer than we ever have been, but it seems we're not quite there yet still. So I don't have any. I'm not a fly in the wall of the Oval Office, so I can't really say more than that. I think that the decision is going to get made eventually, but I don't know how much longer eventually is. I was trying to be optimistic that we were going to see that happen in August or September, but here we are getting closer to the end of the month now, and current reporting is that the decision isn't, or at least there isn't going to be an announcement made this week. So, yeah, I don't know. I hope it's soon. The delivery is not been the challenge for any of the things that Ukraine has gotten. I've been very adamant that I have a lot of faith in U.S. Transportation Command in delivering the equipment to Ukraine once those decisions are made. But it's ultimately up for President Biden to make that decision, whether ATACMS is going to be provided or not. So,
yeah, the tea leaves on this one are particularly inscrutable. And I think the one positive thing I sort of keep in the back of my mind is that the announcement of the decision to deliver these weapons usually coincides with their employment rather than their delivery. So usually we either see a decision made shortly, an announcement made shortly before the employment or shortly after the employment of the weapon system.
What I'd add to that is my perspective has always been that in terms of decisions on the provision of major security assistance items, my perspective, and you know, I'm open to being wrong on this, and I hope I am, not to get too deep into this, but it really does seem like the, at least for the United States, the approach has been to wait until our backs are metaphorically against the wall before providing the Ukrainians with a needed capability. We saw this with the Abrams. We only provided them because we didn't have any choice in terms of getting Germany to provide a Leopard 2 main battle tanks. DPICM, we waited till the last possible minute to provide that as in response to a potential ammunition shortfall that the Ukrainians might have in terms of standard high explosive shells. The F-16s, we were kind of backed into a corner basically by the European allies, as well as the continuing to degrade state of Ukrainian Air Force's Soviet legacy airframes. Obviously, Patriot was a direct response to again, kind of continued degradation of Ukraine's Soviet legacy ground-based air defense assets and capabilities. We are very reactive, not proactive, unfortunately. So my sense of it is that a decision on ATACMS will come probably in relation to however the Joint Chiefs of Staff and U.S. European Command is assessing the progress of the currently ongoing Ukrainian offensive. If they feel that, you know, we're reaching a critical point in terms of the desired level of progress not being made, either in terms of, you know, territorial gains or in attrition inflicted upon the Russian armed forces, then I think that'll probably be the breaking point that drives a final decision when, you know, again, the DoD assesses that we have to send this system to be able, you know, to keep that avenue of success open for Ukraine, which is a very unfortunate position to take, in my view, because we are, not necessarily deliberately, but we are kind of carelessly making that avenue as small as we possibly can for them by being reactive instead of proactive.
Yeah, and there's a lot of debate as well that we won't get into here about what the exact source of friction in the decision-making is. I mean, it's all for... As Colby says, none of us are in the room, so it's all very... It's all speculation at the end of the day, unfortunately. Another technical question that arose that is parallel or tangential to this one. The supplying of M270 tracked vehicles versus the HIMARS wheeled vehicles. Do either of you have a particular opinion on that? Which do you think is more useful, more effective in terms of delivery of the system?
I think so. HIMARS is going to have a smaller logistical footprint just being based upon a wheeled chassis as opposed to M270 MLRS being based on a track chassis. So in terms of supplying it, I think there's probably... HIMARS is probably the more optimal system in many respects. That said, my standpoint has been that we will probably need to provide a significant number of M270 MLRS from U.S. Army inventory. Currently, we have provided none. All of the M270s have come from inventories of European allies and partners. If we make the decision to supply the confusingly named M26 MLRS, which are the original cargo rockets that deliver DPICM submunitions, those developed for the M270 and all MLRS family. If we make a decision to supply those munitions, I believe that will need to be accompanied by a transfer of probably several dozen, maybe a battalion or two's worth of M270s from U.S. Army inventory to give them the launchers to be able to make effective use of that of those M26 rockets across the length of the front line. Because as of right now, they have at least 20, maybe 38, depending on whether or not the 18 HIMARS being procured via USAI, Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, whether or not those have been delivered, open question. And then they only have, I think, either 12 or 13, I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, M270s from, again, European allies. If you're going to be using a large quantity of M26, that's not really an optimal number. That's kind of low. They'd probably want several dozen more M270s to really have that capacity to leverage that ability up and down the front line.
Colby, any preference?
No, I agree with John on that 100%.
Yeah, I think it was a question that was raised with me, and it came basically most of the issues we discussed are around mobility, and HIMARS are definitely more flexible in terms of the terrain that they can traverse. But, you know, for the next few months, they are basically stuck on the roads compared to M270, which is slower, has a lot of other things, you know, around it, but may actually be able to traverse more than just roads for the next few months.
Well, that gets to an important point again. You know, regarding M26 MLRS, Gimlers has a range of, again, you know, 80, 90 kilometers. HIMARS can stay on the roads from, you know, for the most part, and execute fire missions, then just drive off. That's not really too much of a big deal in most scenarios because, again, Gimlers is an 80 to 90 kilometer range. It usually does not matter, again, in most cases, whether or not, you know, it's on a road. It can usually reach its target and execute that fire mission while still staying on a road. With M26, depending on the version they get, they're looking at a range of, again, unguided, you know, cluster munition dispensing rockets here. 25 kilometers with the original versions, I think 35 to 40 kilometers with the A1, with the later A1 and A2 extended range rockets, they're going to have to get very close to the front line to effectively employ those, which means going off-road. And especially, you know, as we get into the fall and the winter, as, you know, soil conditions become non-favorable, the M270s, they're really going to be needed, again, for that role, you know, of using M26 MLRS, because HIMARS is not going to do particularly well in that rough off-road terrain, you know, because it's on a wheel chassis.
Just to swing back a bit, Cobby, you mentioned that the agonizing process that every rider faces, having to get out the razor and dispose of cherished parts of their work. Was there anything in particular that you wish you'd been able to keep in?
Yeah, good question. So I actually didn't take much out in the editing process. I went back and forth with John quite a few times, but there wasn't really a whole lot that got cut out. In fact, I would say, actually, as things kind of came down to the wire, I was making revisions, adding a few more things in that weren't in there originally. I would say, as I was discussing earlier, it's more about just things that could have been put in that weren't. But I didn't actually write it to be extremely long to begin with, or longer than it already was, and then cut it down. I set out, I think, with a pretty good mental roadmap of the things that I wanted to hit, and did all of that, and then, you know, made some revisions from there. But there was no, you know, vast swaths that were subjected to the scalpel that had to be removed for brevity. And I don't think I really have too many regrets about things that I really wanted to be in. As I said, it was already quite long, so the format, posting it as a Twitter thread rather than, you know, a more structured sort of research paper, means that trying to be as concise as possible is more optimal. So I think I'm overall pretty happy with how it turned out. If I was to rewrite it or reorganize it in a more formal structure, then there's probably some things that I would put in. But for the medium of posting it, you know, on social media, I think it's pretty good as it is.
I think Twitter's quite an interesting medium to, or X, as we should now call it. It's quite an interesting medium in that it's sort of neither here nor there in terms of its, like, the way you write it. But yeah, I often find the best arguments are the ones you come up about 2 hours after you've made your submissions. So what kind of feedback have you had? Has there been anything that's really stood out for you in terms of constructive feedback and things that you hadn't considered? Or was the original thing found to be fairly comprehensive, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, the audience feedback was certainly that they, you know, they appreciated the comprehensiveness of it, or at least those that elected to read the whole thing were impressed with how thorough it was. I've been very touched by the positive feedback that I've gotten from lots of different people who found it really informative. So that's been great. Really not much negative feedback that I've seen at all. I'm sure I've probably missed some comments. I have been doing my best to try and keep up with notifications and answer questions that came in the comments, and thank people for sharing it. I haven't been able to get to everybody because my phone has been blowing up nonstop. But yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty positive response. Just sort of like, you know, there was one kind of comment that John knows about that he flagged for me, actually, which wasn't really even, you know, that negative, I guess. It wasn't even really about the content. It was just a more comment about the length of the thread, which is, you know, well taken. It was a concern going in that, like, geez, who's going to read a 70-post long thread? But a lot of people did. And as I said, I don't think that I really could have cut much out without really kind of compromising on the important information. You know, I suppose I could have elected to break it up into a series of threads and cover different topics individually, and maybe in hindsight that would have been a better way to go about it. Do one thread on sort of history and technical characteristics of the program, and then do one thread on capabilities and why TACAMS is important, and then do one more on procurement. As I say that, I'm thinking, geez, maybe I really should have done that. So if I ever regret it's maybe that I didn't give that more consideration. So I guess that's what I'll be thinking about as I lie in bed tonight. Geez, should I have written it in three separate threads and released it, you know, every week or two, drop the next. So much self-doubt now. Did I do this the right way? See, what when we're finished done here, I'll be DMing John. John, did I mess this up? Did I go about it the wrong way? I don't know.
After John's tweet on the Ukrainian missile industry, I'm not sure that I would go to him for advice on brevity.
Yeah.
Well, Colby managed to outdo me lengthwise. Mine was only like 49 tweets.
I mean, that was the final draft, John, to be fair to Colby. That was the final draft.
Yeah. Yeah, I beat John by a fair bit.
The final draft was 40 tweets.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. I did send that to you for proofreading initially after I totally forgot about that.
I don't think I even saw that one. I think I saw it pretty close to completion, I think. But yeah, I don't know. The series, maybe that would have been the better way to go about it. But John, that was supposed to be a series from you too. Did you ever write a second series in that? I don't think you did.
No, I just didn't have the time. I wanted to do another thread on Neptune after I did Saxon. And then, yeah, there was a couple others I wanted to look at. I just never really found the time, to be honest.
I think our audience would be very interested in Neptune, considering its recent resurgence, John.
Yeah, there's a whole new section to add to the Neptune thread now, the new land attack capability.
Yeah, God, that's half that thread is going to be just me angrily ranting about why I think the press is being gaslit by Ukrainian officials as to how they implemented the land attack capability. But yeah.
Well, I'm sure our audience will be waiting for that thread to drop.
I appreciate all the responsibility you've just dumped on my shoulders.
The team behind Tochnia are here to support you, John. And by support, I mean publish your work. And then take credit for it as much as possible.
Yeah.
Naturally.
There's no other way to do it. No, I feel John. I mean, yeah, an awful lot of work goes into writing something like this.
Just for our listeners, be very clear. Submissions for our collective are entirely voluntary, and we don't hold any of our members to timelines or schedules. So there's literally no pressure on John other than the pressure he puts on himself. I think it's very clear for our listeners to understand that. Sorry, Colby, go ahead.
John and I are blinking twice right now, signaling that we're being held hostage. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, a huge amount of work, a lot of it doing research, goes into writing threads like these. And for John, I mean, I had the luxury of drawing on English sources. John had to be like translating things from Ukrainian to figure out his thread on Saxon. So that's even more impressive. I don't know. And I've had to do that myself as well for some smaller threads that I've written, looking at Greek and Bulgarian sources. But yeah, I can't imagine writing 50 tweets on, Ukrainian primary sources.
And you've got to find the right flyer from the right arm show.
Oh my God.
That has the right description. And if you don't get the right one, you don't get all the information. And then you find three different ones with three different. Yeah.
The unfortunate thing with the Ukrainian systems is that really, if you really want insight into them, you have to ask somebody either in the Ukrainian government or the ZSOU. And that's not really something that you can put in a thread or an article typically, at least not usually. There's information out there, but a lot of it's just not, you can get it, it's just not public. You can't cite references for it, which is from my standpoint. I'm well aware the information's out there, but you know, I can't put a decent bit of it in a thread because I can't cite sources for it.
And I guess that's okay. This is an interesting topic our audience will like, I think. How do you start researching this kind of project? Do you just jump on Google? Do you jump on, I don't know, DuckDuckGo? What's the starting point?
So for me, with Saxon, what it was, the raid against Saki, that we obviously saw, you know, significant damage done to that airbase that occupied Crimea by some Ukrainian missile system. Yeah, you know, I was at the time, that was something I wanted to look into, figure out, you know, how the hell did they do this, you know? Because that was really a capability that seemed out of their reach completely at the time. This was before they had Storm Shadow. They only had, you know, their longest range capability was Tochka-U out to 120 kilometers. This was like 400 kilometers from the front line. It was really, really astounding. You know, people were putting forward theories. Oh, it was the Ukrainian soft elements that, did demolition op. Oh, it was UAVs. And it just a bunch of explanations were put forward. All of them, basically all of them, were very unsatisfying. At least in my view, didn't really comport with the evidence. It was always pretty clear to me it was a ballistic missile strike. And we still never really got to the bottom of it in terms of publicly available information, how that was executed. But one of the rabbit holes that led to was Sapsen, which is a prospective Ukrainian short-range ballistic missile system under development before the invasion began. It was referenced in a bunch of, English language Ukrainian media outlets. And from there, I just kind of stumbled across it. Then, I read all the English material from Ukrainian sources. And then I started just diving into the rabbit hole of Ukrainian language publications, figuring out how to search for stuff in Ukraine on Google and just going through these rabbit holes of obscure Ukrainian defense news outlets and just getting transcripts and interviews from, the missile's designer, KB Pivdini, and the manufacturer, Pivdin Mash, et cetera. It was just kind of spiraled from there. So, but I guess to make that description short, honestly, Google is a decent way to start. It's very, very overwhelming at first, especially if you go into it cold without much background knowledge. But at the end of the day, again, especially for, like Ukrainian systems or even, non-US systems for the American audience, a lot of it comes down to just, search engine trawling, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, certainly, I guess in terms of like weapon systems and things like that, the way in which Google works is certainly less of a problem in researching than some other areas where the Google algorithm will basically self-censor and not show you the things you're looking for. Yeah, Colby, do you have...
I mean, I already spoke to kind of what my trigger was, but to talk to the process a little bit. I mean, yeah, a lot of Googling, as John said. You can find a lot after, a little bit of trial and error. You kind of figure out how you have to optimize your keywords and, make use of the advanced search function to look for more specific things, because there are limitations to Google searching when you're just kind of typing in a bunch of things, because it's a keyword search fundamentally. So if you're kind of searching for multiple different keywords at the same time, you're going to get less than optimal results in some situations. So trial and error, and eventually you kind of find what you're looking for. And then once you find sort of one primary source, that can lead you to other primary sources. Wikipedia article for TACMs, there's, a lot there that's correct. There's a lot there that's incorrect, but it cites a number of good primary sources, actually. So if you actually take the time to go look at the primary sources, then that basically led me to a lot of the information I was looking for, or at least put me on the right track to find other primary source information. Once I kind of got into the budget documents and learned how they're structured, and then going through the rest of them, that was the process for acquiring a lot of the information, was just kind of compiling all of those primary sources and then doing the analysis, just understanding like what they're actually saying, because they're very unclear. A lot of them, the way that they present information, and the information is not presented consistently across years. And I had to go through a total of 35 fiscal years worth of data to get all the information I needed. So it was a very laborious process, but that's basically how I went about doing the research.
Yeah, I'd agree that Wikipedia is great as a starting point, because it often contains a lot of sources that you wouldn't otherwise. Like, it's just an easy way to get you started looking for sources and start one of the things you find, as you alluded to, is narrowing down that keyword list in order to find out what actually works, because oftentimes different groups and organizations call things different keywords, essentially, and just narrowing that down is half the battle often. And figuring out what they actually call a thing is often probably the most time-consuming part.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's even more applicable for researching Soviet and Russian systems, as John, I'm sure, can tell you, because they have so many different names, it's kind of insane. You know, all the names of the alphanumeric designations that the Russians apply themselves, and then all of the NATO reporting names on top of that as well. And so trying to find information, yeah, you're going to need to use the NATO names if you're looking for sort of Western assessments about those systems, and then use the Russian names if you're looking for primary source Russian sources for those systems. For ATACMS and most American systems, it's a little bit easier because in most cases you're looking at like 1 to 2 names or designations. But even then, like for ATACMS, you know, a lot of times you might see it abbreviated as just the ATACMS is the most common, but sometimes it'll be abbreviated as Army TACMS. So that's kind of one example of where changing your keywords a little bit can yield different results. And finding keywords that are associated with ATACMS would produce certain information that just searching ATACMS wouldn't. So you'd search for, you know, just another sort of subsystem or something associated with the missile, and searching for that might give you something that a search of ATACMS wouldn't, even if even if ATACMS itself was present in that same document. Just the way that the algorithm and I guess the indexing of different websites and documents works is a little bit strange. I definitely do not fully understand how it works, but through trial and error, I was able to find pretty much everything I needed, although certainly there's probably still, I know for a fact that there are open source documents out there available that for whatever reason just never came up in any of my research. But I feel I have a pretty complete picture of the information that I needed, at least to write my thread.
So it was one more source you could have included. That's what I find. There's always just one more step.
Yeah.
One thing I'd add, I guess, from the perspective of foreign language sources, so in my case, or non-English language sources and material, it's a struggle. The difficulty is going to vary by language, but it really is genuinely a struggle. The biggest difficulty is, you know, not searching for the names of things per se. It's searching for general terms for things, because they're often the literal translation of them is very, very different. I'm just speaking, for example, for Russian, Ukrainian in relation to English. The terms that they use to refer to groups of things or categories, the literal translation of them is very, very different. So, you know, what we would call a short-range ballistic missile system or a tactical ballistic missile system, they would call it a operational tactical ballistic or an operational tactical missile complex or something like that. The terminology is very, very different. There's a lot of nuances in the translation. And I honestly, that was probably the biggest difficulty for me researching SAPSN or any of the other, you know, Russian, Ukrainian stuff I've dug into. It's just that the fundamental terminology and how it's translated is very, very different. They'll call, you know, the booster motor for a missile, they call it the marching stage. Or, and I'm sure, a large fraction of that is just quirks of literal translation. I imagine if you had an actual interpreter, they could, you know, go through it and give you a much more graceful and smooth conception of what you're reading. But especially if you're dealing with, like, machine translations, that's very difficult to work around. You know, how do you phrase your search terminology? You know, I can put SAPSN into Ukrainian, I can put it in quotes, I can search that on Google. But, you know, how do I say terminal guidance? How do I say that in Ukrainian? How do I put that into text format? How do I search for that? How is that described? What words are used to describe that in Ukrainian or Russian? That's a very difficult process to work through if, you know, you're like myself and you don't speak that language or languages.
I guess another thing, it could even just be as simple as the use case for an item, right? The AK-47, when it was introduced in Russian service, it's a submachine gun. And I believe that in some cases, People's Republic of China still refer to their Type 56s as submachine guns, whereas we would call it an assault rifle in inverted commas. So yeah, sometimes it can be as simple as just like the use case for the item as well, is because it's understood differently, it then attracts a different designation or a different use of language.
Well, as an example of that, I have to point this out to you. It's an AK, not an AK-47, in terms of the actual Russian description versus the English description.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. And how much virtual ink has been spilt because of this? I mean, the Kalashnikov platform is particularly notorious for this, at least in small arm circles, of arguments over typology and nomenclature. If you're interested, check it out. If not, I don't recommend it. But yes, John is quite right in that the divisional nomenclature is, in fact, after Mike Kalashnikov. Please don't comment and tell us about this. We know.
I have to correct Alex because he's the small arms guru.
We are aware of these arguments. Please don't explain them to us. So yeah, what's next? What's the next sort of thing on both of your horizons, missile-wise?
Slam at your throw, question mark?
Or otherwise. Well, we've already settled that John's going to do a Neptune thread, so that's fine. We've sorted John out. Colby, Slam at your, what's next?
Yeah, there's a number of different competing priorities. No rest for me. I certainly feel like I deserve it, but there's just too many things that I want to write about. So some of them time sensitive as well. So I high degree of certainty about what I'm going to write about next. Well, it won't be about any particular weapon system. I definitely do not think it will be a 70 tweet thread. Hopefully much shorter than that. Hopefully as concise as possible. We'll see. So I have an idea of what I need to get done in the next couple of weeks, really, actually, in terms of the next sort of project that's going to require some level of research. Beyond that, as John said, I've been teasing after Attackums that Slam ER is something that does need to be explored because it's the most realistic possible system that Ukraine could receive from the United States to fulfill its need for ongoing sustainment of a long-range precision strike capability. So probably a good idea to get ahead of all of the bad takes that will be forthcoming when that finally makes more of an appearance in the mainstream discourse here on Twitter or X. Because right now it seems like John and I are really the only people talking about it, but hopefully that's in the cards in the future. So that's probably a high priority, I guess, to write about that. But we'll have to see. There's always changing circumstances and other things that you want to write about. So,
yes, the information cycle is a harsh and unforgiving mistress. John, Neptune aside, is there anything on your mind at the moment that you'd like to share?
I mean, in terms of, I guess, that I want to potentially write or that I've considered writing, one of the main things I wanted to talk about at one point, I never really got around to it, was after the announcement surrounding DPICM that the shells would be provided to Ukraine. There was a lot of bad takes surrounding, you know, DPICM and cluster munitions in general and their provision to Ukraine, you know, in the first couple of days after that announcement. It's dropped off pretty dramatically since, although they still pop up here and there. I had wanted to write something about the role of cluster munitions in modern warfare. How do cluster munitions interface with the modern trend of precision-guided munitions? How do they complement each other? How do they overlap in terms of the capabilities that they bring to the table? I had kind of had an idea of how I wanted to approach it, but I never really had the time to kind of sit down and really develop that idea as much as I want to, or, you know, let alone put it to paper.
I'll just say that in the wake of the cluster munition announcement, there were a lot of people that wrote threads about the topic of cluster munitions, but I think that's a specific angle that John outlined there that I don't recall seeing anybody writing about. There were a lot of different technical focused threads, but none that really took, I think, that specific lens. So in my opinion, that would be, you know, a useful addition to the literature, although the moment may have sort of passed now. As John notes, that people are, all the bad takes have subsided somewhat since the first flurry. And I wrote my own thread about cluster munitions. I came at it from a policy and procurement lens, which obviously those are the things that I talk about most on Twitter. And so it's interesting that, you know, with any given topic, there's so many different angles you can take on it, so many different subtopics to explore. And it's, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of the bad things about social media and Twitter specifically and all the misinformation. But at the same time, there are a lot of smart people that are taking the time to share some of the knowledge that they have or some of the research that they've done and put that out there to try and inform people and improve the discourse. And that's one of the reasons why I still enjoy being on the site and continue to use it on a daily basis. It can be a good source of information if you want it to be. A lot of people sadly don't, but if you want it to be a good source of information, it can actually be quite unrivaled, I'd say.
I think certainly in terms of instantaneous reporting, there's very few platforms that rival with that. Sorry, John.
No, I was going to say, there's a unique aspect to Twitter, both in terms of the fundamental structure of the platform and the more specific technical features it offers to users that I don't think has really been captured anywhere else. I mean, every major social media platform has its own angle. Snapchat has an angle, Instagram has an angle, Facebook has an angle, TikTok has an angle, Twitter has an angle. And out of really all of them, Twitter is the most, I guess maybe by coincidence, the most well suited for the dissemination of information, interaction, and engagement with that information. In this sense, I guess discussion. There's no other social media platform that replicates that. I mean, obviously there's Blue Sky, which is kind of like a Twitter clone that isn't really fully finished yet. But I don't know. It's a certain uniqueness to this platform that. Or I should say this platform, to the Twitter platform, the platform formerly known as Twitter, that hasn't been captured elsewhere, and I don't think really will be as a practical matter. And so it's, I guess it's a shame to kind of watch how it's developed over the past, you know, 6+ months.
This is almost certainly a podcast in itself, which we may never make.
Yeah, pontificating on the evolution of social media platforms, that strays a little bit beyond our mission statement, I guess.
Specifically Twitter in the last 6 months, I think is perhaps a little beyond. And there are other commentators who cover this topic. That being said, I believe both of you are present on other social media platforms. So if you have your pluggables ready, plug away. John?
Yeah, I'm present on Blue Sky. My handle is, give me a minute, I'll pull it up. Yeah, just @johnridge.bsky.social. Just pretty standard. I'm on there.
Also on Twitter.
Yeah, @John_A_Ridge here on X platform, formerly known as Twitter, yeah.
And Colby?
I suppose that I do have a Threads account via my personal Instagram, but I do not use Threads. I never posted. I looked at it once, was not impressed by what I was seeing, and have remained on Twitter since then. So you can find me here on Twitter. I don't anticipate leaving, but who knows what the future has in store. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter.
Thank you once again to John and Colby for giving us the time to have a chat about their work. This has been Tochny Talks. You can find us on Twitter or X as @Tochny, and you can listen to us on your podcast app of choice. And thank you very much for listening. Slava Ukraini. Героям слава.
On behalf of the brave.